You are very welcome to Cawley's Call with me, Alan Cawley, powered by Benetti Menswear, a topical debate show covering all things Irish football, along with 1v1 interviews with top-class sports stars from a wide range of different sports.
It's me that's putting on the green jersey, me that's going to take flak from people to say, you're not even Irish. I was big enough to say, I'm going to take it.
There's many people I've spoke to, they always say, I used to put money on you scoring the first goal, but I've never seen any of that money, though.
And Andy, he says, I want the performances that I got from you in Scotland with you under 16s, not that rubbish that you gave me over in Oslo.
Hi everyone, and you're very welcome to Cawley's Call Series 2 Episode 9, and we're delighted to have you back. We have to mention before we get into anything on tonight's show, the reaction to Chris Forrester's interview last week was absolutely brilliant, and we really appreciate all the texts and messages and all sorts from everyone. Hopefully that's the case for all of them going forward, but certainly Chris was brilliant last week. And I know we referenced the fact, Stewie, that he was the most mannerly guest we ever had. Well, tonight I'm continuing that theme, and I have probably one of the nicest men I've ever met in football, in the legend that is Jim Beglin. So I'm really looking forward to chatting to Jim. Stu, great fella, great bloke, and as I say, a gentleman. So we're continuing on that theme from where we were last week.
Yeah, and what a player as well. So I really enjoyed the Chris Forrester interview last week, because it was brilliant how he opened up. He did. I think even he was a bit surprised by it, because afterwards he kind of mentioned it and thought he got a bit he ran away with himself a little. But it was brilliant. It was so natural. It was so normal. And it deserves the reaction it gets, you know.
And a side to him that we've probably many people haven't seen before, because he's so laid back and almost nonchalant in the way he plays, because he's technically so good, and he's not one of those players you see him on the pitch and expresses himself kind of vocally. It's almost in just in how he plays. So for him to come in and open up and discuss different things, I thought it was brilliant.
Yeah, and I think we were very lucky, because it's difficult to get players to really talk about, I suppose, stuff outside of football, really, you know. There's, you know,
especially personal stuff.
Personal stuff, exactly. Yeah. I mean, I personally felt when I played, and it'd be interesting to see even maybe what Jim felt, that it's just, we kind of grew up in an era where there was a mistrust of the media, of journalists, and you don't really know what to say to them. And I think there tends to be this stereotypical interview style everyone kind of goes to, like a default position where you just kind of talk about quite bland, normal stuff, and you don't want to give anything away. But social media has brought out a different side. It's given players the opportunity to kind of express themselves, even though some of them might make big mistakes doing it. But it's definitely a thing. People out there, the supporters, they want to hear. They want to kind of get under the skin of the player. They want to hear. They want to. Oh, don't tell us the normal stuff. Give us a bit of, you know, what's your world like, you know. And that, like, last week was great, because we got a little bit of Chris's world.
Brilliant, yeah. As I said, the aforementioned Jim Beglin is with us. Jim, good evening. How are you?
I'm good, Alan, but I think you've misread me.
No.
I've obviously got an awful lot to do to live up to last week.
You have a lot. Now, let me see, right? You have a lot to live up to last week, because Chris, this lad blew us away, Chris Forrester, player in the league here, Jim. He's outstanding. But the reason you're on straight after Chris Forrester is because if there was ever a man that could live up and probably beat Chris Forrester for manners and being such a lovely man, this is you, Jim. This is you.
I'll do my best.
How are you anyway?
Good. Lucky to be busy, you know, with the football, kind of, because people need their football. It gives them a lift. So I think once the government over here kind of you know, relax things in that regard, it was great to get Project Restart going and to be able to continue. I consider myself very, very lucky. It's kept me sane. It's kept me going, to be able to kind of do the thing that we're passionate about now. Obviously, the playing days are long gone, but the you know, the commentating, thankfully, has been very busy. And obviously, with everything been condensed into a smaller spell, into a smaller season, there's been more to do, so it's been crazy, and I've really enjoyed the busyness of it all.
That's one thing as well, Jim, dear, you mentioned, obviously, and we're going to touch on a lot in terms of the career that you had and the very successful career that you had and playing at one of the biggest clubs in the world. But the commentary and that second part, I suppose, of your career, or the life you live now, has almost taken on a life of its own, because you're every bit as famous for your commentary as you were for your playing.
Yeah, I think that people have said that to me in the past, that kind of you're especially for the younger generations coming through, that, you know, they won't remember you as a player. They kind of know you as a co-com. And yeah, I mean, I can remember people kind of saying to me at various times that you should kind of do more punditry. But with all due respect, and I know you guys do that, I never really took to punditry, because I always find that in studios, you get some great analysis. I have no kind of problems with that. But an awful lot of it is speculation, conjecture, maybe if this, that. I've always been kind of a person about what's happening. And when I'm co-common, what's happening is fact. And I'm putting my interpretation on the fact. And I was always drawn to that, you know. And I remember people saying to me, you know, the odd producer, it's going to harm your career. You're going to kind of lessen your career if you don't try and, you know, open up both pathways. But I kind of stuck to my guns, and I concentrated on the co-com side of things. And thankfully it's worked out. I'm still getting away with it. And I love it. I just really enjoy it. Yeah. And I suppose it's true that people do think that, you know, I'm a co-com and never really was a footballer.
Noel, I think as well, as Jim, the reason it has worked out so well for you is because you're very good at it, and that's what it boils down to. Stewie here does a bit of co-com and obviously the punditry with me. Go on, Stewie.
Oh, I actually wanted to ask Jim this, because this is something that I suffer through, actually, and it's listening to myself talk. I get, you know, I don't know whether, Jim, you might have got it in the early days, maybe you've learned to deal with it. But a lot of people, they feel, yeah. Oh God, what way am I coming across here? You know,
no, but when you're doing the commentary or the punditry,
the co-commentary.
Okay,
I don't know if you feel that way, Jim. Do you? Is like sometimes you hate the sound of your own voice, or you kind of almost nearly don't trust your own opinion. Sometimes it's very, it's hard to articulate, but there's a sort of
a doubt
there,
insecurity.
Yeah.
No, that's true. I can remember certainly in the early stages that I went through all that. That I kind of went, when I started off, I, even though it was suggested to me that maybe, you know, because people had heard me do a little bit of radio work back then, and they were suggesting, well, maybe, you know, with you retiring prematurely, you could kind of go down that road. And I never really committed to that. So I was kind of doing it in a way of just filling time initially, kind of trying to figure out where my life was going to go. And then it kind of hit me, you know, that, oh, I need to start taking this more seriously. I need to turn this into a career. I need to be more professional about what I'm doing. And that led to me being more critical of myself. I would beat myself up if I, you know, felt I called something wrong or I said the wrong thing. And I to this day, I hate the sound of my own voice. You know, the stuff we do on the weekends goes out on a Premier League review programme, which goes out on BT Sport here and Sky Television. And I never watch it. I still don't. I can tolerate a little bit more of myself, but I don't, because I'll probably say something that I'd be critical of. Again, I'll be moaning at myself. Well, why did I say that?
But even after all these years, Jim.
Huh?
Even after all these years, are you not? Because I find I'm 8 years doing it now. And at the start, I was a little bit like that. But now maybe I like the sound of my own voice.
You like that, Jim, not mind him. He loves the sound of his own voice.
Just now and again, I'm generally much more comfortable and relaxed in what I'm contributing these days to what I you know, was contributing back then. Obviously, you know, experience over the years helps in that regard, and it kind of calms you down. And I don't beat myself up in the same fashion. But, you know, I think if you're not prepared to kind of keep your own standards high and be prepared to have a little go at yourself now and again, then, you know, you might kind of get a little bit too complacent about things. And I never want to go into that realm, because I, you know, ever since like my playing career, you're programmed as a pro into, you know, being a certain way and kind of wanting to maintain standards, and that's carried me right through my life, right through into my broadcasting career, and you know, even though I'm much calmer about everything nowadays, I will now and again still get irritated with myself. It's only natural.
That's the word for me, Jim. Standards. When I started this, I wanted to treat it like a job, and I'd like to think people can see that. very well prepped, going to games. And I always feel comfortable when it comes to discussing the game afterwards,
yeah.
when I know I have my prep done and my research done. And then I find that I'm quite comfortable. I would actually feel really uncomfortable had I not been prepped going on, because I know there's people that do that, but I don't know how to do it.
Yeah. Well, I would. Clive Tilsley once said to me, said, your career is your prep. And I would have to disagree with that, because it's not. There are, and I watch, I'm always watching football. The missus is always having a go at me because I'm kind of, you know, watching. You're watching more football? I said, yeah, because the games I'm doing this weekend has a different set of circumstances around each game. And you have to get your head around everything. And I think it's very true. Prep is really important. Mm. Each team plays differently, and they have a different set of circumstances around each club as well. And I can remember back in the day, I went to do a game down at Birmingham. And I remember I was doing BBC Radio, and John Inverdale asked me a question about something that was going on in the Birmingham boardroom at the time, which I wasn't aware of. This is in the very early stages of my broadcasting career. Mm. I wasn't aware of, and I had to say to him that I wasn't aware of that situation, and I can't give you an answer. And I could sense his frustration that day. And as I drove home that night, I thought, that can never happen again. Mm. And prep is everything. I would tell anybody who's thinking about going into journalism or what we do as ex-players, be a co-com or a pundit, prepare, because once you prepare and you get it in your head, then you can let it come out whatever way it comes out in the studio, whatever way your emotions are, but it's there. You have the knowledge, you know the score, you know what's going on with each team and what this match represents, etc., and you can just let it all flow. And what I would also say to anybody, you know, who's thinking about a career like that, improve your vocabulary. Because you need to have a wider thesaurus in your head. Mm. And I worked on that. I did it through a lot of crosswords. I used to be mad for crosswords. And then bit by bit, you kind of build up a word base. And then you can compete with guys you're sitting beside who are all university educated, all qualified journalists. The George Hamiltons of this world, Peter Drury's, John Champions, you know, those guys. And I've learned an awful lot off them as well, you know. And I still like to, if I'm watching games, I still like to make little notes, just write things down. And then I can, if you've got a bad game, you know, you can look down at the notes and maybe just, you know, throw in something insightful that that ordinarily, you wouldn't have come up with, you know. So I like to write things down as well, because I think it tends to stick in my head better.
Brilliant advice.
Jim, you mentioned the fact that... That because you didn't know what was going on with the Birmingham situation, that was a turning point for you, and you felt you needed to, you know, to be much more informed. Okay,
yeah.
How would you have gone about doing that? Because the reason I ask this is we're spoiled for choice now, because whenever I do a co-com game, and I presume you're the same, and it's probably been like this for the last number of years, you're given a lot of information by a researcher in the background, or we're also very lucky in the fact that we've got immediate access to social media. All sorts of information is out there. In fact, probably too much information. How would you have dealt with it back in the time when all this information wasn't ready available?
I just tried to read up more. Back then, I would just try to get any information I could. You know, I'd scour the newspapers. Anything you might just get a little line that you could tie in with another point you're going to make or whatever in the comms. So yeah, it was more difficult back then. And then it just with television and pretty much showing everything, it kind of opened up, and it left pundits and kind of co-coms in a position where you couldn't go on air anymore and say, well, I haven't seen much of this team.
Mm.
You know, that was just wiped out. Mm. So I learned, you know, that there's huge competition over here for people who want to go down the media route now. And I kind of learned pretty quickly that, wow, this is if I'm going to try and hang in there and stay up with it, then I'm going to have to kind of knuckle down and make sure I'm delivering what I need to deliver, you know, because I want to be better than him or, you know, or her, as it is nowadays. And Yeah, and so while it was very hard, Stewie, back then. You know, it wasn't as easy. Like if doing an Ireland game, if say that you're playing Luxembourg. I know we played them recently. And kind of, you're not really going to know an awful lot about Luxembourg. You're almost learning as you go through the game. You know what the centre back is doing, and you know, is the centre forward any good? You kind of pick it up that way. But it was a lot harder back then. And another thing I'd like to say as well, that I'm really lucky that I came through my early stages without social media, because social media. Yeah. Can be absolutely brutal for a commentator or a pundit or a co-com at times. Whatever you're doing in a game, you'll be criticised, because whatever you say will be deemed biased by one set of fans or another. Mm. So you can't win. You cannot win certainly as a co-com and often as a pundit. And people are always kind of out there ready to pulverise you, to criticise you, no matter what you say. And I'm lucky, really. I like to think I've developed a thick skin over the years, but I'm lucky that even though I'm on social media now, that I wasn't on it back then. It didn't exist then, because I think it would have been very hard. And I think for some young and up-and-coming broadcasters these days, I think it can be really, really difficult. Lots of people just get rid of their Twitter accounts, for example, because some of the abuse just gets out of hand.
Yeah, it does. It's toxic. We're not big fans of it, so even though we use it, but I wouldn't be a fan of a lot of what goes on there, Jim.
Yeah.
And to be fair, I think the one thing as well, what I would take out of that conversation for young people listening that maybe want to go down that road, even though what you're saying, Stewie, and obviously we are spoiled and we get the packs and different things, I still do my own notes. I wouldn't trust the researcher. I don't mean that in any disrespectful way towards a researcher or anyone like that. But there's been incidents where I've looked at a pack and I've actually had a different stat and I've gone back and checked it. So that's another thing as well. Don't always rely on maybe a researcher or a pack that you might be given. So it's just little quirks that people have their own way of doing it, and that was always the way I've done it, and I've kind of stuck to that. But Jim, as I say, you're well established at this stage and you're very good. You don't need to worry about those things. But go back, take us back to the playing career, Jim, and where it all started, and obviously Waterford and on to Shamrock Rovers, and before we get to the Liverpool stuff, what was all that life growing up as a young boy in Waterford?
Soccer mad family. My dad was a Liverpool fan all his life. My older brother was a Man United fan. I became a Chelsea fan from the 1970 Cup Final. I think I was 6 going on 7. My younger brother is an Evertonian, Tom. My older brother, Ed. And we were daft. You know, we'd be out of Kilcone Park back in the day as well, when Waterford were a good side back then, pretty much won the League of Ireland every other year. The Alfie Hales and co. And they were magical times for me. You know, I loved all that. I can remember being a ball boy and throwing the ball to Bobby Charlton to take a throw in for Waterford. And it was just, you know, I remember just being in awe. My mouth was wide open. I can't believe this guy. He's my hero. Mm. I joined Bohemians of Waterford when I was about, I had been with Bolton Wanderers, who sadly have since folded only recently. But I left and went to Bohemians, I think, when I was about maybe 12 or 13. And then it really began to change, because, I mean, it was a good side. And we pretty much did the double every year, won the League and Cup in all the kind of junior leagues. And then it went from there. I remember going to Gormanston College. I had kind of trials with Munster, and I got selected for the Munster team. And then I went with Munster for the interprovincials, Gormanston College. And we had the semis and the final on a weekend. And I can remember seeing John Giles and Eamon Dunphy on the touchline. And I said to myself,
I hope they weren't doing analysis.
No, just as well. Although I think they might have said something nice about me.
Okay.
I remember we played Connacht in the semi-final, and it went well. You know, I can remember, and I can remember actually trying to put on a show for them.
Okay.
I can remember trying to. I just thinking I have to kind of give my best now, and obviously I was noted because. Before long, I got a shout to go to Cannes with the Irish under 17 team, and then it began to kind of take off because John Giles had left because he had another commitment before the end of. We played Mexico in the final game, and he'd gone. And I remember in Nice Airport, Eamon Dunphy sat me down, and he offered me a contract at Shamrock Rovers.
Okay.
And I mean, that was huge for me. And I remember having to go back home and explain it to my mum and dad, who were a little worried about me because I'd gone to Westfalia in Germany with the Munster team as well around the same time. And this is just before my leaving certificate. So they weren't happy about the fact that I was kind of deserting the country, you know, in the build up when I should have been studying. Mm. And but like, I had that in me. I had that in me ever since I was young. I had that dream. I want to be a footballer. It's all I ever dreamt about. Scoring at Wembley, all the usual things, but that was the big moment. And we then went with my mum and dad. We went, God rest them. We went to Dublin and we met John Giles, and I basically agreed to sign for Shamrock Rovers, professional terms. And I was delighted because I always kind of hoped that that would be the stepping stone to something bigger. And of course,
it
didn't go down well in Waterford at the time. And I've done Q&As back home over the years, and I've been asked this many times, but I think Tommy Jackson was the manager at the time. And I think people in Waterford weren't happy that I escaped, you know, and I went to another club. I went to a Dublin club, and that shouldn't have happened. And why wasn't I taken to Kilcone Park and kind of brought through the ranks? So I think there was a bit of a backlash. And I think they just came up with stuff to try and just, you know, make it go away. And they basically said that I was asking for too much money.
Okay.
Which was laughable.
It was really unfair as well, Jim.
I was never even approached.
Really unfair as well.
Yeah. It was a joke. That, I mean, many people have said that to me over the years, you know. I signed for Shamrock Rovers on, what was I on, 50 punts a week. Okay. And by the time I paid my digs money, you know, I had nothing left. You know?
Tell us, Jim, because we obviously know John and Eamon, iconic figures in football, and John for being one of the greatest ever, if not the greatest, and obviously Eamon, the eccentric character that he is. And I've worked with Eamon, and I have to say he's been very good to me. I'll always say that about him. And John is a gentleman as well. But go back to that conversation, Jim, sitting down with an Eamon Dunphy giving you offering you a contract. Was he eccentric as eccentric back then as what he obviously we all know him as?
He was a bit, yeah, because, I mean, I played for the Ireland under 18 team, and he was kind of he wasn't your average coach. He was a little off the cuff. I mean, he obviously, you know, saw the game in his world. I can remember we went to Swansea and we drew 2-2 with Wales, which was a great result for us. I mean, a Wales team that had Mark Hughes in it, if I remember. But we ended up slipping up at Talca. We played them in the home leg, and Wales went to the European Championships and we didn't, you know. And I can remember, like, there was somebody had one of those dodgy magazines, shall I say. And he said he'd award it to the best player on the pitch from that night. So there was a bit of eccentricity in the likes of that, you know.
I'm trying to think of what the modern equivalent would that be.
David Kelly, Dottie Kelly. I do remember a redhead. You may not remember him. He's a little striker and good little player. You know, Joey O'Brien, you know, those guys were in that team.
Was Eamon in the magazine as well?
Do you know what? I wouldn't be surprised.
Oh, brilliant.
He could well have been, yeah. But there was a little bit of eccentricity on the go. But you know, not too much.
No, and you mentioned there, obviously, John as well, and the moment there where you threw the ball to Bobby Charlton. But John was obviously, I wouldn't say, well, people can argue, but he was our Bobby Charlton as such over here, Jim. And I suppose for him to manage you, and as you say, you growing up as a kid looking at the great Johnny Giles, how influential was he on your career?
Well, I mean, I've spoken about this many times, that hugely influential. John Giles turned me from a naive country lad into a hardened professional.
Okay.
Yeah, because from day one there was no even though he's a nice man, there was no kind of softness in terms of, you know, what he wanted. There was a level of professionalism that he upheld all the way through, and you had to meet it, and if you didn't meet it, he'd let you know about it. So he was, you know, there was kind of a cynicism in John as well. He could be very, very tough at times, but always fair. I'll say that about him, always fair, you know. And like, he had a photographic kind of memory of everything that happened on the pitch.
Okay.
Like, quite extraordinary. I remember Harry Kenny, when we were playing one day, Harry Kenny tried to nutmeg someone. And at half time, he absolutely ripped into Harry saying, we were going grand, you tried to nutmeg him, you gave the ball away, then that led to that, led to that, led to that, and bang. And, you know, and he was spot on. He was usually spot on in everything he said, you know, in terms of his analysis. And he could be very, he was very hard. He was hard and fair. And, you know, I was very lucky because he loved to pass the football. Mm. That's what he was all about. I mean, he changed things at Milltown in terms of the pitch. The pitch was beautiful. I mean, everybody loved coming to play at Shamrock Rovers, Glenmalure Park, because the surface was always glorious, where everywhere else you'd go around the League of Ireland, like, there were mud heaps, you know? And, yeah, and he basically set me up perfectly for when I moved across the water to Liverpool, because, you know, I've gone from kind of a passing setup to another better passing setup.
Yeah.
And I was ready for it at that stage. I'd been hardened enough by then, and I'd had enough experience in what was a very tough physical League of Ireland back then. You know, there were no half measures when people went in for tackles back then, I can tell you.
And on that as well, Jim, I suppose, before we get to the move to Liverpool, which is just about to happen, but those 3 years and as you say, the standards that John was setting, do you think nowadays, and I've spoken about this with a lot of people, do you think that's kind of gone out of the game now, that it's almost a bit, it's gone too far in regards that they're a bit too soft on lads,
yeah.
Where I still think there's a balance to be met with, as you say, with the likes of what John, how tough and hard he would have been, but fair.
Yeah. Do you know, my son asked me to do it a while ago, and I've actually got a draft letter, which I haven't edited yet. I haven't taken any further to Gianni Infantino, who's the boss of world football at FIFA. You know, I out of concern, I've loved football all my life, but I find it hard to love it at the moment at times, because I honestly think that it's turned into a cheat fest. And it's because there's never been a deterrent put in place for what's going on. And while you're absolutely spot on, Alan, there's no way I'd ever want to take it back to what was going on in our time, because there was a culture of doing people back then. People were breaking legs. Shocking, some of the challenges that were going on back then. But now, if you breathe on somebody, he falls over and rolls around, and will, even if you've touched him on the shoulder, you hold his shin for 2 or 3 minutes, you know. And I just think it's embarrassing. And for me, just watching the Premier League, even week in, week out, the players are refereeing the games, because the players are going down supposedly to say, well, he's touched me, ref. But, you know, there should be a basic amount of contact allowed again. And, of course, the whole business with penalties this season, I mean, penalties are way above the average this season. It's because the players know that VAR will check everything. So they're going down on the slightest touch all the time, you know. Remember, it's a contact sport. We still believe it to be a contact sport, but they deem themselves untouchable now. And there's so many players going down, and I don't like that. And I think you're absolutely right. I think that they should review it, and they should try and find a happy medium. There is a happy medium to be found in there somewhere. Look, you will always get the subjectivity in terms of, you know, the contact and the exaggeration of that contact. And you'll have people say, that's a penalty. No, that's not a penalty. That will always be the case. But I think it's gone too far. And it's hard to enjoy some games. I have to kind of bite my tongue now and again.
Yeah,
I agree. Shut up.
I agree totally, Jim. And as you say, someone who's so passionate and loves football, I'm the same. I've been an anorak for football and would watch match after match. I genuinely find it hard to watch now, I have to say, with the introduction of VAR, the implementation of the rules and what they're doing with the game. They're destroying the game that never needed to be destroyed.
But is this bringing home a more a bigger thing here? And what we've seen with the European Super League stuff, you know, what's gone on, is there a sort of a detachment now between the game and the supporter? You know, whereby the game has kind of been driven forward by money and, you know, guys in suits making these decisions on, you know, yeah, we're going to have this rule this year, we're going to bring in VAR. I mean, you know, when VAR came in, obviously, its first implementation was off the back of goals, you know, being able to determine whether a ball went over the line. That was always
clear and obvious.
That was always my understanding as why VAR was being brought in. To clear up whether a goal was a goal or whether it wasn't, which makes sense.
Goal line technology, which has been a huge success because it's black and white.
Black and white, exactly. But why, where did all of a sudden it just sort of came? Oh yeah, we're going to use it for this and for this and for this, and it's all of a sudden Jim,
you commentate on the Champions League regular, so I find watching the Champions League games, they seem to implemented far different than what they're doing in the Premier League every week, and it seems to work far better.
Yeah, because I don't think they re-referee everything as much. I think VAR in the Premier League is kind of re-refereeing. Look, I've got to be careful what I say now because I work for the Premier League and I hear VAR in my ear, and sometimes I get frustrated because, you know, all you hear is, checking, you know, and then, you know, check complete. And I just think some of the things that are being checked, I just think that the game seems, they said they wouldn't re-referee it, but they seem to be re-refereeing it for me. And I don't think they do that as much in the Champions League. And again, you know, I can remember being at the Burnley-Newcastle game a couple of weeks ago at Turf Moor, and Tarkowski just swiveled to kick the ball away from a set piece, and he caught or came close to catching Sean Longstaff, nearly removed his head, and there was a big review on it. And I'm thinking, we've reasoned it out, thinking, well, you know, he's endangered an opponent. He was a bit reckless, but he didn't see the opponent. That doesn't really matter anymore. So we've reasoned it all out, and we think it's got to be a penalty anywhere else on the pitch, and it's going to be a free kick. And of course, what happened? They didn't give a penalty. So second half in that game, the exact same thing happens outside the box, and a free kick was given.
Kick, yeah.
And I don't understand what some of the reasoning is. I mean, you know,
I don't think anyone
everything we were told at the start of the season now seems to have gone into a bit of a haze, and you're never quite sure exactly. And you think you've reasoned everything out by the law and the circumstances in each, because you have to judge each one on its merits. And then you end up thinking, well, how have they arrived at that decision? I don't know.
It's barring me.
I was encouraged at one stage thinking that it might help the game, but I think more and more people now are just utterly fed up with it. And, you know, the stuff I see on social media particularly. And
I
think it's here to stay, Alan. But you know, I don't like it now.
I'm the same. I never liked it from day one. I love the goal line technology, but anything that becomes subjective, I don't want at all, because it's a fella in a box opinion versus a fella on the pitch's opinion, and the fans have a different opinion, and you in the commentary box a different opinion. I have a different opinion. So anything that becomes subjective, I just don't want it at all in the game. Like, they're trying to say, when they're comparing like with like, they're not. At Wimbledon, at tennis, the Hawkeye, because it's like the goal line technology, it's out or it's in, it's definitive. Anything that's subjective, I've no time for. But Jim, anyway, I want to press on because I want to get to the glory days of Liverpool. And a lot of people talk about Klopp and Guardiola and Mourinho and the managers that are around nowadays. But you have been in the presence of management royalty, Jim, for many a year with Bob Paisley, Joe Fagan, Kenny Dalglish, and I suppose to be never mind to be in those people's presence, but to be managed by those great men must be some feeling for you.
Yeah, I was a little worried initially because I was Bob Paisley's last signing.
I have that note here, last signing made by Bob Paisley, yeah, £20,000.
Yeah. Well, I began to wonder, did he resign because he thought he lost his touch when he signed me? I didn't get to play under Bob because I signed in April 83 and he lifted the trophy. I remember that year, I think that Graeme Souness let him lift the trophy because he was packing it in. And Joe Fagan, of course, took over. And I was playing away in the reserves. And, I remember November 84. And I wish he hadn't told me, but he told me on the Friday at lunchtime that I was playing against Southampton the next day in midfield. I played on left midfield. Mm. And I didn't sleep a wink that night. And I told all my family. And I met him off the boat the next morning in Liverpool, and we went for breakfast, and I can remember as well on the Monday we drew 1-1 with Southampton, and Roy Evans pulling me to one side and saying, you know, you could have done better on the goal that they scored. But I was exhausted at that stage. I was emotionally drained, because it's not just physical and mental. I mean, it was hugely emotional for me, and at the end of that game I was running on empty. And I was partly blamed for the equaliser. And of course, you know, you were always told it was a hard school, Liverpool. It was a hard dressing room. And
all those things that we've heard, sorry, Jim, about that, Souness, Alan Hansen, the great players, but the toughness of the dressing room, all that was true, yeah.
Yeah. I can remember reading that Bob Paisley had spoken about Avi Cohen, who was a left back, preceded me. And he couldn't cope with, even though he was Israeli, he had excellent English. He had immaculate English. He couldn't cope with the banter. He couldn't handle it.
Okay.
And the banter could be severe. You could get picked on for nothing, and you get the whole dressing room on your case.
Who'd be leading that, Jim?
Say again?
Who'd be leading that?
Souness was the man back then. Souness was probably the toughest of the lot. Mm. And, you know, he had the personality, he had the character to stand up to anything. And, you know, everybody kind of followed with him. But, I mean, I can remember, they played together. But, I mean, before I got in the team, Jimmy Case was a hard man. Tommy Smith back then. There was always somebody who kind of led the way. You know, and I played with Ronnie Whelan. Now, Ronnie isn't renowned for being a hard man. But let me assure you that Ronnie was deadly.
Okay.
For delivering that kind of thing now and again. I was hopeless at it. If I started trying to get involved in that, then the game would fall apart.
See, we're back to the niceness again, Jim, you see. Yeah, like it must have been, I suppose, the names just roll off the tongue in terms of the players and the quality and Liverpool at the time and how successful they were. I suppose for you going into that, was it daunting initially going into the dressing room? And at what stage, Jim, or at what point, is it 20 games in, 50 games, do you feel comfortable at home in that environment?
I initially was in the other dressing room, even, you know, for training. So it was with all the reserves and the younger lads. And then, you know, once I began to get taken with the team, I moved into the other dressing room. And yeah, it was a little daunting for a while. You had to kind of feel your way. And I always try and keep my head down and keep quiet and just try and kind of ease my way through things if I could. But it didn't always work out like that. Yeah. As I say, you'd get picked on, but you had to be able to kind of stand up to it, you know. And then, you know, bit by bit, played on my debut, and then immediately got injured playing for Ireland in Denmark afterwards. So I missed a spell, and then got back in the team towards the end of the season, and it went really well for me then. And then I was given a new contract by Kenny Dalglish when he took over after Heysel. And then I began to really plough on, and I felt a part of it. I felt I belonged, and you know, my dream had come through at that stage. Not that I was ever going to kind of, you know, relax at things. You couldn't. The standards were ridiculously high, and they held you to account on everything. You were accountable for every little mistake, and Ronnie Moran would be barking at you, you know. And that the standards they set were incredibly high, and you know, I liken an awful lot of what existed back then to what Klopp has returned to the club now, and he's kind of recovered those standards. again, you know. And I played in a side that scored lots of goals. In fact, I think the 85-86 season when we did the double, I think was the highest scoring season ever for a Liverpool football club, which is saying something, you know. But we had Dalglish and Rush. And, you know, I think Jurgen Klopp's team came within about six goals of it a couple of seasons ago. So very attack-minded as well, like we were back then, you know. And I was having the time of my life until, you know, a certain night at Goodison, unfortunately, in 87. And, you know, that was the beginning of the end, you know.
At that stage,
I was strong, I was fit. I'd learned from my mistakes. I knew my role in the team. I knew when to do this, when to do that. And, you know, it was I was obviously gutted. I'm the one who gets the violin out now and again because, okay, you know, my story is a sob story.
Yeah, but it is a sad story, Jim, obviously, looking back on that. And you mentioned you played in an era when you felt there was dirty tackles or there was a time when people were going out to do each other. Did you feel there was intent on Gary Stevens' part that night?
With all due respect, I don't want to go into it again. Yeah. I mean, I've dealt with all that now. I realised very quickly that I had to compartmentalise that, just put it away in the back of my brain, and move on from it, because otherwise, you know, I'm going to be kind of a bitter person for the rest of my life. And if you have bitterness in you, it just tears you apart. So I actually learned to deal with that, and I'm absolutely, you know, fine with it now. It happened. I went through the whole feeling sorry for myself routine, which is only natural. I went through all the emotions, and I've put it to the back of my mind. It's back there now, and I don't like to revisit it. Now and again in the past, my son has made me dwell on it because he's persisted and he's kept on asking me about it, you know. But I am, and he'll get me going. He'll get me agitated, and he'll get me a little angry from that experience. But, you know, overall, I've just had to kind of put that behind me and move on, because for me, the glass is always half full in life, and I've always seen things that way. There's no point in dwelling on setbacks and disappointments. If you dwell on those, your life is going to become a bit of a mess. And I was never prepared to allow that to happen to me.
Brilliant. And I'm glad that you have moved on from that, Jim. But the last question, there's two players I want to actually ask you about, Jim, before we let you go. And you've been great with your time. Thank you. I'm a huge Alan Hansen fan, not only as a player, but I loved him as a pundit. And I still think he was the best pundit around. Just how good a player was he? And then I want to ask you about Kenny Dalglish after that, Jim.
Alan Hansen was brilliant. And I don't say that lightly. I don't say it because he's a friend, an occasional golf partner, you know, and a teammate. But he was brilliant. I've had many a centre back in the past who would put me in the you know what while I'm getting closed down. So they put me under pressure. Big Al, when he was ever kind of faced with that possibility, he would always just drop the shoulder, swivel back inside, open the pitch up, and ping one into Dalglish's feet. He was just he was remarkable in terms of his composure and how easy he played the game. He was lovely on the ball, really silky on the ball, and he never went to ground. He never slid in. Mark Lawrenson loved a sliding tackle. They complemented each other beautifully. Laurel loved the sliding tackle, last ditch effort, you know. But Big Al would always stay on his feet, and he was just great to play beside. The amount of times I thought, well, he's going to put me in it here, and he wouldn't. He just, like as I say, slip back inside, leave a centre forward in his wake, you know, and he could step up the pitch no problem as well. And he was fantastic. But he was the wind up merchant in the dressing room.
Okay.
He got everybody going, and he gave everyone a nickname. I mean, I roomed with him. When Alan Kennedy moved on, I moved in and roomed with him. And he was mad for Dynasty. And on a Friday night, we'd always be away in some hotel. For an away game, we'd always be in some hotel. And he had his little routine. He'd be the first away from the dinner table. And he'd go and he'd ring Janet, his wife. And then when he finished with Janet, he'd have Dynasty for an hour, then we'd have Guidazain Pet for an hour, and then we'd have Cheers for half an hour, and then lights out.
Okay, brilliant.
And that's the way it worked. And because I was, he was always like Kenny DeMonge. You remember Ken? Ken DeMonge was at Liverpool at the time, and ex-Home Farm, and a guy called John McGregor, who was a Scottish lad who got injured, very unfortunate, because he was going to be a hell of a player. And he'd always go to those guys on a Monday and say, what was Beglin up to on Saturday night? What was he doing? Who was he hanging around with? What did he pull? You know, this kind of thing. And he'd always kind of, you know, find that information just to try and use against me and wind me up. But he was like ultra competitive as well, still is with the golf. I used to play a game of cards with him, and he'd sulk if I won.
Okay.
He'd get into a strop if I won. But a great guy, and as I say, absolutely brilliant as a player.
Yeah, I love Hanson. Stewie was a bit like that with us, but Emmerdale. He used to love Emmerdale. But Jim, the man himself, we have to finish off, I suppose, asking you about King Kenny. As you says, he offered you the new contract, played under him, played with him, an amazing player. He still has such a huge impact on the club nowadays as an ambassador and all. But is he the greatest Liverpool player ever, Jim?
Well, we are all from different eras will say different players. There'll be, you know, others who will say it'll be Steven Gerrard. There'll be people who say it's Graham Souness. People will go back to Billy Little, who was, you know, huge for Liverpool back then. But for me, yeah, and my time, I think I played with the greatest ever Liverpool player, and I would say it was Kenny Dalglish. I just remember kind of initially being in awe. I remember when I got first taken away to a first division game, it was West Ham, it was Upton Park, and I was 13th man. There was only one sub back then. I was 13th man. I remember getting on the coach thinking, keep your mouth shut, keep your head down, read the paper. So that's what I was doing. And of course, Dalglish said to me, you know, I'm doing a crossword here, Jimmy. And I'm struggling on the last one, you know, and it's the classic, the postman's bag. And I went, sack? And he went, no. And I went, satchel? And he went, no. And then I said something else, and he went, no. And then he burst out with the answer, you know, too many letters. And he got a great ticket. Everybody thinks because of Kenny, you mentioned like being maybe a little kind of opposed to the media back then. I think one or two things Kenny didn't like in the early stages of his Liverpool spell, and he was always, you know, wary of the media after that, and he used to kind of tell us just to be careful. But he came across sometimes as a little dour when he was being interviewed. Mm. But complete opposite, and he was a Mickey taker.
Okay.
He was another wind up merchant. That's all he did, trying to get people going, you know. But like in terms of his presence around the place, he was the natural successor to Joe Fagan to become the first kind of player manager, and then to do the double in his first season. I mean, you know, incredible. And it just added to his legend. And I can remember he came back in around the March time, I think, February, March time. He got fit again, and he came back into that side in 86. And we'd had our little troubles along the way, but his presence back in the side just sparked everybody. It just got everybody going. The standards were up again. If I bounced the ball into Kenny's feet, he'd snarl at me. You know, he'd want it basically, you know, along the deck, nice and smooth, so he could do whatever he wanted with it then. And he could turn a defender whichever way he wanted, you know. And Kenny was the one that would kind of, you know, uphold the standards. Mm. You know, he would not let anything drop below what he always did. And he had an aura about him. He had an aura. He was a natural in terms of his footballing ability, but he was as shrewd and as clever, as canny, as they say in Scotland, as canny as you like. And he was made to go on to be the great that he is at Liverpool. And he'll always be way up there in my estimation.
Okay, brilliant, Jim. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on, and we really appreciate you taking the time to join us tonight. We could talk to you all night, actually, but you did every bit as good as Chris Forrester did last week anyway, so don't worry. But thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Alan. Thank you, Stewie.
Thanks,
I enjoyed
Jim.
It.
Take care.
All the very best, guys.
Thanks a million, Jim. Okay, Stu, Jim Beglin, legend.
Yeah, no, he is. I have to say, I've always... I grew up listening to Jim doing his commentary And I've always felt his voice very, I found it very calming, very informative, very educated. You know, he was such a super footballer, had a great career, and obviously ended prematurely. But you could see, you know, it's very, very, very difficult for someone like, you know, for someone in to be put into that situation in his career where, you know, you have to kind of move on to something else, you know.
So soon.
Yeah, so soon. Yeah. A career-ending injury. It's something I've often probably would have even related to with Richie as well. Like, you know, it must be a very difficult thing to be told to know that you can't
no more.
You can't do this anymore. Like, mm-hmm. you know, and you're so young. You've got so much left in you. So I would always give those guys huge credit for reinventing themselves, pulling themselves.
Because it can be easy to go down the other road.
Oh, completely. Yeah. You know, and a lot of other people have have gone down the other road, like, you know, and I'm sure would have regretted that. But he didn't. He picked himself up and is now one of the most respected pundits out there. Like, yeah. You know, and I love listening to him, like, you know.
No, he's brilliant, yeah. Okay, Stu, we're going to review the matches. Busy weekend again. I had a lad on Twitter, actually, and please get in contact, anyone with Twitter, Instagram, whatever, if you want any questions. But I don't know, his name is in Irish, I don't know, is it Mickey O'Donovan or Paddy Donovan or something, but he basically says, will you talk about this tonight, and will you talk about this, and you better talk about this as well. I said, I'm nearly going to invite him onto the show. But the big talking points, obviously, that he was referring to and what he wanted to talk about, the big game at the weekend, Stu, Shamrock Rovers versus Bowes, 2-1, I was up there in Tala, brilliant game, probably the best game I've watched since Dundalk Shamrock Rovers last year when Flores got the brilliant goal, the 3-2 game that was in Tala.
Yeah, yeah.
And considering that had 7,000 people, which I feel added to that night as well, this had nobody, and it was absolutely brilliant. The standard, both teams, we've often commented on the surface in Tala, immaculate, yeah. Which helped. Bowes played brilliant football, and the first half, to be fair, I felt was kind of, it was like a basketball match. It was so open, up, down, new attack. It was, we loved it as neutrals. We were watching the match and chatting to a few people that were there and different journalists and things. It was great for us. I'd say the managers were up in arms because it was so open. And considering the Dublin Derby, which are generally, they're always good games, but maybe not as open, I'd say the managers at halftime were saying, here, we need to change this quick. Bowes in the second half were outstanding. Best team on the night. I think their second half performance edged it for them. They were brilliant. But they lost. And ultimately, they lost due to a debatable penalty. And I have to be honest, where I was sitting, we were over on the east stand. Paul McLaughlin was over that kind of left-hand side,
yeah,
of the pitch,
yeah,
where the incident happened. Initially, my reaction straight away
looked
was
a penalty.
Yeah. It did look a penalty. I've since watched it back and the replays, and as everybody has mentioned on social media, it's very, very soft.
Yeah, it's very soft. And it's when you look at it from behind the goal, you can see it's the view of the referee that has effectively made up his mind, because Mandrew's kind of cut right across his vision of Finnerty. And when he's
and
looking
he gets
at
in
it,
front of Finnerty.
Gets in front of Finnerty. And when the referee is looking at it, Finnerty's behind him and he just sees the arm coming up. And I suppose he's reacting straight away to that. And, you know, Mandrew's gone down under any, which is what any player is going to do in the modern game, which I've a big problem with, you know, and this is a huge part of the problem in the game now, is that it's way overprotective towards the instigator. You know, it's just too easy to give them. When you look back at it again, it's harsh. It's extremely harsh. You think Finnerty, you know, he's gone with the run. He's getting himself across.
Like, he doesn't barge him.
No, he's putting his arm up for his own, probably for his own balance more than anything. If he slams into him with a shoulder, he's probably still going to give the penalty as well. Like, you know, but I think it's harsh, and it's given Rovers even the penalty from Bourke. I mean, the keeper should save it.
Yeah.
You know, and Calvin, it's kind of, it's like a double one. It's like, you know,
and he sent Finnerty
and
off.
He sent him off as well. Yeah. So
now that's where I'd be critical of Paul. Paul obviously got a lot of criticism over the weekend. As I say, my initial reaction, Stu, at the time, I thought it was a penalty. But where I would be critical of Paul is you can't send him off. What happened to this rule, double jeopardy and all? And there was an incident before that as well, which I think you should look back on, that Sean Gannon pulled down Bert. Now, whether he was going in on goal, but he was probably going to get a shot off. He only booked him. So obviously Keith Long was aggrieved over that as well. The only thing Keith Long can take out of this, they've lost four games now, which is a poor start for Bose, but they were brilliant on the night, Stu.
Yeah, exactly. And I think I know it's difficult for them to take, and especially being Shamrock Rovers as well, but the key thing for me is definitely the performance. Definitely the performance. Bose to me look like, when I've watched them so far this season, they look like they might have had a lighter than normal preseason. They don't look at it yet, and the only thing I can think of there is that they're trying to get this team ready to kind of peak later on in the season, because I think what they probably found difficult last year, they had such a good season, started so well, kept it going, and might have just dropped off towards the latter part of the season, which would lead to the fact that they got mentally, physically fatigued. And it's a very, very difficult thing to do in the game. You have to kind of really...
And the turnover of players as well. There's fellas settling in. The lad Bert played well. Georgie Kelly's come into the team. Ali Coote in midfield. The little lad played really well, actually. Left full. Tyreek, he was brilliant on the night. So there has been a turnover of players, which is difficult. And that's always the problem for Bose as well. I've often said it here. It must be so frustrating for Keith Long to lose your best players at the end of the season.
Oh yeah, it must be. It's extremely difficult. Extremely difficult. Any manager will tell you that. Like, you know, but it looking at them now, if it is the case that they've tried to maybe set themselves up in pre-season so that they're not sort of peaking in the summer, they're trying to peak towards the end of the season, which is the business end, where you might win a cup, you'll guarantee to get yourself into Europe because you have a strong finish.
And they should be the aspirations for Bose. They're not going to win the league, but they could win a cup.
No, I think so. I think they're well capable of winning an FAI Cup. Mm. Anyone's well capable of winning an FAI Cup, and certainly well capable of getting into Europe, you know. So
where you can actually get at Shamrock Rovers, Stu, I think, and for people looking in at them, and we've seen them already, they haven't been as comprehensive in the games that we've seen. But what I thought was brilliant was Keith Long tactically. They're playing with almost like a box in midfield. So you have Chris McCann. He started with Dylan Watts, two of them sitting. But he plays with almost two number 10s. So you have Burke and Mandrow, almost like free to roam around here, there and everywhere, particularly Burke. But what was brilliant the other night, I felt, with Bose, and they were brave. This is the key thing. And maybe not all the other teams can be as brave, or they don't have the quality to carry it out, maybe. But they had Buckley, Ali Coote, but Ross Tierney played as almost like a number 10, but was always dropping back. So they were almost outnumbering the two, because Burke and Mandra won't work back, or they won't run back. So you had Buckley, Ali Coote, Ross Tierney against McCann and Dylan Watts, and they were being overrun every time in midfield. I thought it was brilliant from Bose. You had Keith Ward playing narrow as well, because Wardy's not going to fly up and down the wing. He was coming in as another body, almost doing what Shamrock Rovers do to teams when they have the four. But Bose were actually brave enough to go to Tala and do it to them, and be really good in possession. Bert as well, and they were just totally outnumbering them.
Yeah, no, and look, you have to also point out there was definitely an added energy to Bose in this particular game, and it just looks to me like they're starting to kind of go through the gears. I mean, to go to Rovers to put it up to them. To be very, very unfortunate to lose, not just to lose the game, but should have come out with a hell of a lot more than they did. You have to take them ones, that, and they're difficult to take, but you have to take it because you can't let it affect your game. And Bose are in a kind of, I wouldn't say they're in a difficult situation at the moment, but I don't think they're in where they are at the moment in the league is not reflective of where they should be.
No, I agree.
You know, and they can't allow this spell to get on top of them, because they need to move up the table and quite quickly. And if they keep playing like that, it's very, very simple. They'll be up that table in no time.
Well, this week they have a huge game, Stu. Bose, they're playing Derry City. And of course, Derry City were all over the news last week. Declan losing his job. It didn't come as a great surprise to me, I have to say. I said it the night we were up in Derry last week. I also said it back here, and you and Kenny were slagging me at the first week of the season, because I just felt losing to Longford, he got off to the worst possible start. And I know people are saying six or seven games in and it was a bit harsh. I just felt, and I hate saying this because I've great time for Declan, but I just felt coming off the back of the disappointing last season as well, it wasn't just six games this year. They were very poor last year as well. And I think that filtered in. Losing to Longford was a disaster on the first night of the season, and following it up against Waterford as well the following week. So he got off to the worst possible start. Rory Higgins came in. I think it's a good appointment. But again, Rory, no experience as a manager. He's highly regarded when he was for his time at Dundalk. He obviously had a good career. We played against him many times. I know Rory really well and like him. I hope he does well. But he got off to the dream start.
Is there anyone you don't know really?
There's a few gobshites.
I thought about this. Let's take Declan's Devine situation. It's black and white to me. I think it had gotten to this stage where they weren't progressing under Declan, and it was the right decision to make. Now, the difficulty you have is that you can't change manager unless you've got somebody ready to come in. So they've obviously been looked at the Rory Higgins situation. Probably spoke to Stephen Kenny about it, because I would imagine the club would hold Stephen in very high regard with regards to his advice, and whether he'd be happy enough with it, you know, with the approach.
By all accounts, he was fine with Stephen.
Looks like absolutely, and you can't deny it. Like, you know, the opportunity is there to bring in Rory. He is very well regarded in the game, even from his time at Dundalk. And look, he's coming in with some serious experience now, being part of the Irish setup as well, and dealing with younger players. But they definitely needed the change. There's too much that's gone into the club to see them, to kind of falter and to get, you know, they're in the relegation battle at the moment, and the club has really moved forward. And you're right. I mean, I think they looked at the whole tenure. Last year was the difficult one for them, and I do agree. The Longford game, it just hasn't picked up since.
No, because you look at Longford's form since, and you look at Longford at the start of the year. I know they're suspected them; they're coming up from the first division, but the squad that they have, Derry City should be beating Longford, and I think Declan got off to the worst possible start you could imagine, and he was on the back foot straight away.
Yeah, it was the manner of the defeat as well. Yeah. If you look back at the goals, they're just getting pushed around, really. You know, this is Derry City. You expect them to go to Longford.
Derry City massive
and
club.
Really put it up.
And
to
by
them,
the
yeah.
way, I watched that documentary, the Derry City thing last week.
I haven't seen it yet. I am dying to see
brilliant.
It. I'm dying
it's
to see
absolutely
it.
Absolutely brilliant.
Yeah. I'm dying
the
to
scenes,
see it.
Where we were there last week, and the scenes of them coming down the hill for that first game, I think it was against Home Farm, they arranged a friendly. Was it at Home Farm?
Did they bring 17,000 to a
Pats game?
The scenes
are unbelievable. Yeah. No, down to Cork.
Or Cork, down to Cork.
Unreal. Like, unbelievable.
But this is the sort of stuff that we're trying to maybe engage people with, like, you know, this used to happen.
Oh, it's true. And not that long ago. Like, the footage is incredible. Go back to the 80s and Jim McLaughlin and all. It's amazing, the footage to have, and how successful we were, and Jim coming back. And
Should we need to bring back the 80s full stop?
I know, we do need to bring back the 80s. Yeah. Speaking of the 80s, you're recording music all weekend, so you are in the 80s. But Derry City got off to a great start with the win, Stu. I watched the game. Both Sligo Rovers were very, very disappointing the whole night, considering they're on such a good run. We've praised them high. They've been going really well. They had a great win away at the Bows last Tuesday night. They followed it up with their worst performance of the season at home to Derry. They never laid a glove on Derry.
Yeah, inexplicable as well. But this is the issue that Sligo are going to have.
Inexplicable. I'm getting my own back now for you on a week is a long time. Inexplicable. What the fuck is inexplicable?
Inexplicable is a word. Okay. Do you remember bounce back ability? It's a new word, inexplicable.
Inexplicable. I love it.
Your
inexplicable.
Your jumper is inexplicable. Can someone put up a pic? He's wearing a pink Nike jumper.
I think I look well.
All right. It's inexplicable to me. Let's go again, right? That performance was definitely inexplicable to me.
No, it was
look,
terrible.
It's the inconsistency, isn't it? It's the such a good start. And look, this is always the difficulty in the game. You know, you get your plaudits, you get a little pat on the back, you're going well. Suddenly the players start to believe the hype a little bit, and then could be
a good kick up the arse.
Well, they need to make sure it's the kick up the arse they needed, because consistency at this level, you know, if you want to win league titles, if you want to contend for league titles, if you want to get yourself into European competition, consistency at that level is the most important thing, you know. And you can't have this up and down drop in performance, and it is unexplained. You know, maybe within the camp itself, they can put their finger on it, but they certainly need to react off the back of that, because it's still quite early in the season. Now, if you go on a 2 or 3 game poor run, you're suddenly down there, you know.
Because you can already see at the top, Pats and Sham 17.
Season's taking shape. Yeah, league's taking shape.
And
big
they're pulling
time.
Away. Like, there's a gap there because no disrespect to Finn Harps and Drogheda, who are in fourth and fifth, but they shouldn't or won't really be there, we don't think, come the end. So there's a gap opening up there already. You look at Bowes and Dundalk mid-table at the moment on 6 points. So 11 points, a big gap already. Like, for
The season, the I always felt 7, 8, 9 games is when people are really starting to hit top gear. It's a funny enough season so far in that you wouldn't say that about Rovers. They're not really at top gear. Dundalk have a lot of ground to make up. A big win for them. I just wonder, is there enough for them to get right up that table? But
that'll all depend now on an appointment. But they had a big win in the Louth Derby. They won 2-1, Stu. They played very well in the first half. To be fair to Drogheda, they came back into it in the second half, played really well. Bit of a turning point, and or you could say a big decision went against Drogheda. The lad Zahibo could have been sent off. I think he was lucky enough to get away with it, but it was a big win for Dundalk, and it was an important win to just get a win.
They just needed a win. Yeah. It's as simple as that. Like, you know, if they had come out of that game with just a point or whatever, it would have been very, very deflating. You know, the club is going through a big transitional period now, and it's key that they're just picking up points until such time as they can get the right person on board. Who that's going to be, I don't know. But I do think the club has to make the right decision now, so it might take them a while to kind of come to a decision. That mightn't come to a decision until the summer, maybe until somebody becomes available. I don't know what the thoughts are. I don't know whether you've heard.
No, I haven't heard. It's gone a bit quiet.
It is quite quiet. Yeah. Unfortunately, what tends to happen is you get a lot of names thrown in the hat. And Robbie Keane, Vinnie Pert might go back. I think that's a bit lazy. It's a kind of lazy journalism kind of thing. Like, you know, I would well imagine that in the background, they're trying to see what their options are. Maybe not rush the decision. They don't want to get the wrong person in there.
No, definitely not. But the team who keep producing, we obviously had the man himself on last week, Chris Forrester, and then they went up and beat Finn Harps 2-0, Stu, with a great win. They've continued their great start. They're on 17 points out of 21. Stephen O'Donnell would have snapped your hand off for that kind of start at the start of the year.
Oh, completely. I think, you know, we got a little bit of an insight, didn't we? You know, with chatting to Chris, not just his own stuff, but just the mentality at Pat's.
It's changing.
We spoke. I mean, we would have spoken about it even back when Stevie first got the job. And it's supporters and players, unless they know what we're talking about, it's difficult for them to understand when we talk about a kind of there has to be a mentality at a club. It has to be a hunger and a desire and a.
Sure, you heard Jim Beglin there talking about John Giles in the 80s and the standards, and obviously Liverpool and all. You have to have standards, or else you forget about it.
Yeah, and like even my own. If I think back my own career and then about yourself, like, you know, you don't realise how in it you are until you actually retire, and then you kind of look back and go, Jesus, I was inexplicable.
I'm going to say something to you now. I don't think I've ever said this to you, but the first time I ever knew what it was like to be a professional footballer was when I signed with Chelsea and went into that your dressing room. Because I was a young lad in England who didn't really know the opportunity that I had. But not only that, I didn't know what it took to be a professional in terms of how you're supposed to live your life and dedicate your craft, to be dedicated to your craft. When I came home, played with UCD, which was great because Paul Doolan set standards out there and it was great for me. But when I went to Shelburne, and all of a sudden, as Jim Beglin said there, it's like going from Shamrock Rovers to Liverpool. When I went into that Shelburne dressing room and Pat and the demands he was putting on every day, but then it becomes player driven and yourself and Owen Heary and Jim Crow. And then I was living with Ollie, who was living like a monk, and the professionalism that entailed as well. And that was the first time, Stu, and I'd like to think since then on, that's how I carried on then as a professional in and out of football.
They give you life lessons. They give you standards for life to adhere to. Like, I mean, I have the same approach now outside of the game, even, you know, towards my job and all. Like, you know, I mean, I'm you know, I hate being late. I panic when I'm late. Like, you know, and you know, you kind of learn to set your own standards, and you live by a very basically very, very high standards, like, you know. And it's a good trait to get into. It's a good life lesson, you know. It'll always help. Of course, sometimes the difficulty can be that you maybe you're a little bit too in it, and you can be a bit too harsh on yourself and you're not really enjoying life. But to get back to the point, the Pats players have bought into this now, and it's taken, I don't know how long Steve's in the job, it'll be two years in the job.
18 months, yeah.
Yeah, 18 months, it'll be 2 years in the job at the end of towards the end of the season. But 18 months takes time, but my God,
they're in it.
What a chance they're in, and Rovers not at it really, so it's
and they've already gone to Tallaght and showed what they can do.
They put it up to them, yeah. They just need that belief in themselves, and they just need to keep going and keep believing that they can go and do it.
The other result was Waterford beating Longford 1-0, a big win for them, considering there was a few off the field issues last week with Kevin Sheedy, and is he gone, is he not gone, but he's staying, and that's good. But Longford are struggling, let's just say that. And they have been struggling now for the last couple of weeks after their good start. But the fixtures for this week, Stu, Drogheda are at home to Sligo Rovers, Pats, Longford. You fancy Pats as well in that one. There's another chance to pick up another 3 points. Finharps at home to Shamrock Rovers, Waterford at home to Dundalk, and Bowes at home to Derry City. The results in the first division: Athlone 3, Wexford 0. Athlone are flying. Treaty 2, Cork 1. We need to discuss this at some stage as well. Cork City, Stu. They're nearly at the bottom of the first division.
Yeah, it's
division.
Incredible.
It's a shambles.
I mean, even with a young squad, that's...
Treaty United, a new team.
That ain't
and I have
enough.
To give credit to Treaty, Tommy Barrett as well. Tommy done a great job in difficult circumstances with Limerick, and now he's been literally put a team together the week before the season, and he's been getting results. Fair play to him, and he's a really good fella, Tommy Barrett. Galway 2, UCD 2, Cabinteely 1, Shelburne 3, Cove 1, Bray 1, the Women's National League, Bowes 0, Piemont 3, Cork 0, DLR 1, Galway 4, Treaty United 1, and Wexford Utes 1 at Lone 0. Stewie, that was episode 9. It was an unexplicable episode, but I enjoyed it, and you were busy over the weekend recording. Fair play. How's
was,
everything
yeah.
going?
Yeah, I was recording a song called Are We At War?
Okay.
So keep listening out for it.
People can hear it next couple of weeks maybe?
Yeah. We'll try and get out as soon as we can. Like, you know, I don't tend to sort of do all these releases like all those other big punces do.
Big photo shoot, yeah. No,
I can't do that shit, no.
No.
Just put it out there.
MTV, big photo shoot with MTV.
No, just put it out there.
Is MTV still going?
It is, isn't it? Yeah.
Is it? Okay. Stewie, it's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Al, yeah.
See you next week. Just before we go, thanks a million to Paul Morris as well, and also to Benetti Menswear, because without them we wouldn't be here, and we really appreciate the support. So talk to you next week. Thank you
for listening to Cawley's Call, powered by Benetti Menswear. For more interviews like this, please subscribe to my podcast or follow on all my social media channels.